Hello and welcome to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Your Insights. This week, I am joined by our head of news, Robert Leeming.
Hi, Oliver.
Our senior infrastructure analyst, Dila Cipici.
Hi, Ollie.
And this week, we are lucky to be joined by Scott Lawrence, founding partner at Glenmont Partners, who leads the firm's solar initiatives and is actively involved in new financing initiatives. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been a very busy week. We've got plenty to cover. We've got deals from the last week, which Rob's going to take us through in a moment. And we've also got this week's big announcement, the Green/Energy Security Day announcements from the UK government, which we will be covering shortly. But as always, we begin with the news. Rob, what have you got for us?
Well, thanks, Oliver. A few deals that would like to highlight this week, starting in the solar space, Foresight Solar. Last week, we've written about quite a few times. The fund announced that it's going to back 6 subsidy-free solar projects in Spain with a really large capacity, 467 megawatts, spread across a group of different projects. The rights to develop these projects were sold to the Foresight Fund by the Spanish grid operator Red Electra and a local developer named Grupo Suerva, which is, I think, going to still help to develop these projects in Granada. This move follows Foresight's sale of several solar farms to Infinity, which happened at the start of the year. So it's been quite a busy year of kind of buying and selling for Foresight, and I think there's a few more deals on the horizon from what I understand.
Very interesting to keep an eye on that solar market. We've been seeing quite a lot of activity of buying and selling there. I think particularly often cited is that issue with getting the permits ready and getting those grid connections set up. So that might be leading some of this, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, that's a major problem across Europe. The money is there to build the projects, as I've said before, but getting the permits to actually get these projects built is a real problem. And that's it's a problem in Italy, it's a problem in Spain, it's a problem in Germany. I think Italy have passed some legislation recently to make it a little easier to develop solar projects. I think on industrial land in Italy, you need a little less paperwork. So
I'm looking at our solar expert guest, Scott.
Yes, hopefully
we might
agree.
Get onto that later.
Happy to chip in. So I guess it is an issue, right? I mean, if you think about any renewable energy asset, a solar project included, there are 3 phases to it. And there's the development, the construction, and the operating phase. And that development phase tends to take quite a long time, depending on where you are, and is very complex. And, you know, we have this differentiation internally between what are megawatts and what are bragawatts. So it's really like diving in and understanding, does this project have a chance to come across the line? And these local permitting issues are a big part of that. And so is, of course, national government policy. And so anything that can be done to make that easier is, of course, appreciated by the industry.
What else have we got, Rob?
Well, while we're on the subject of solar, there was another interesting solar deal. Enesco announcing that they've broken ground on 4 new solar farms, 110 megawatts for Gresham House, which is been building a solar portfolio for some time, I think predominantly in the UK to start with, but I think if I remember correctly, they're looking to kind of internationalize a little bit. The 4 projects in question were the 50 megawatt Law Farm in Skegness, 20 megawatt Beaver Grange in Devon, 2 further 20 megawatt solar farms in Derbyshire and Gloucestershire. They plan to have all the projects online by the end of 2023, and they'll have a lifespan of 40 years. So that's another step forward for Gresham House, which has quite a large solar portfolio now, if memory serves, and they want to.
Yeah, of course. It's very obviously important to get through the financing stage of these projects, but actually seeing these announcements that they go further than that and actually break ground, because it's so important to get these projects off the ground and getting that capacity into the grid.
And now moving from solar to floating wind, obviously newer technology, much newer technology than solar, and certainly not as tested. This week, the Norway-based renewables developer BW Ideol and the French state-owned investor ADEME, they basically said that they're going to work together to develop some floating offshore wind capacity. The two companies are now in exclusive negotiations, and BW is hoping that the French end of the deal is going to provide up to 40 million to kind of build some floating schemes off the coast of France. BW Ideol has done a few floating deals in recent times. They've got some capacity that they're developing in Japan, which is a bit more advanced. France, of course, is quite running quite behind on its offshore industry in comparison to the UK. They've had a lot more problems, again, with getting things approved and bureaucracy and all that kind of thing. So it'd be interesting to see how they fare as they kind of develop this project.
Obviously a huge part of the success of any of these projects in France, particularly in these sort of new floating sections, will be exactly how sponsors approach the new auction process in France. And obviously that's going to be a huge success if they get it right. And that experience from the Japanese market will probably
help,
at least on the technology side.
Yeah, well, that's the big problem, the technology side. I think there was a deal in France at the end of last year that Total, I think, was taking part in. And they backed out, basically, saying that I think they said the technology wasn't quite right. From floating wind, we're jumping around quite a bit, now to hydrogen. I was talking to Carsten Johansson last week, who's the head of the private equity and infrastructure transaction team at Impax Asset Management. And they've done quite a lot of deals in the traditional infrastructure renewables sector. In fact, they were one of the first big investors to back renewable technology back in 2005. Anyway, I was talking to him about where they might be looking in the future for investment. And he was saying, well, last year they kind of delved into battery storage for the first time. And he was highlighting that as an area of future investment. And he also said that hydrogen is looking quite juicy for the future. He said, we clearly see that there's a big strategic rationale for hydrogen, and we are quite certain that this market will mature over time. We are monitoring it from the sidelines to be sure, but what we are still trying to get our head around is not so much the technology, but the revenue models. We want to know how we can get a steady revenue stream out of hydrogen, which is a problem that is obviously going to have to be solved. These infrastructure investors are going to want to know how they can get the most money, the biggest return on investment, and they're not quite clear on hydrogen. It's the same with electric vehicle charging as well, which I was talking to him about. Basically, it's an interesting prospect, but they're not entirely sure the best way to get the most money out of it at the moment. So, but it was interesting to hear that he's thinking about hydrogen.
Now, that's certainly a really interesting take on the market. Now, certainly that hydrogen business model. So one of the things we're going to be looking for, particularly this week out of the announcements we're expecting out of government, is more detail and more clarity on how those revenue streams might come about. We've got the hydrogen business model, which has been slowly revealed over the last few months, and we're expecting some updates on that possibly within the next few days, which hopefully should give more clarity to those kind of projects. But obviously the kind of certainty that you can get from a hydrogen project in the UK is currently, at least, looks far, far less secure than some similar projects which you could argue in the American market, where, of course, the Inflation Reduction Act is giving those guarantees on production costs at sale.
Yes, exactly. Yes, we talked a little bit about the IRA as well, and he was saying exactly what you said, basically, that America has become much more of a hospitable setting for investment. And he was basically saying that, yes, they need a kind of similar thing here in the UK, really.
Yeah, sure. So we are not, let's say, making hydrogen investments at the moment, but we continue to make renewable energy investments here in Europe, of course, but more recently in Asia Pacific and also the United States. So we are, let's say, very well represented in the Tennessee Valley Authority, let's say, region of the U.S., and we've welcomed the IRA. It took what were already good projects and made them great projects. And so I think it means that there's a tremendous amount of political will to grow the industry. There's, let's say, a tremendous amount of political will as well to create jobs. And I think, to the extent that Europe can do something similar, that would be welcome for the industry and this particular geography.
Moving on, I think we've got one more news story, Rob.
The EIB this week announced that they were going to back the development of the Portuguese grid. This is another problem that's holding back renewables projects, not just kind of planning problems, but also making sure there's enough high-quality grid to support all the capacity that's coming online. It's a problem in Spain, it's a problem in Portugal, it's a problem in Germany. So last week, the EIB pledged to issue a 450 million green loan to bolster Portugal's REN plan, which is basically a blueprint for strengthening the country's electricity transmission network. Financing is going to contribute to the project's ultimate goal of modernizing and improving the country's power infrastructure to support renewable energy expansion, minimize carbon emissions, and promote sustainable economic growth. The loan agreement's been made between the EIB and Portugal's transmission system operator, so that's obviously going to be a big help there, where there's an awful lot of solar capacity coming online at the moment, for obvious reasons. Causes a lot of sunshine, I assume. And Portugal's very nice.
Known for it.
Yes.
Go ahead.
You know, grid is one of those things that is exceptionally important, and it's always an optimization problem, isn't it? I mean, you know, to get onto national grid levels, let's say 440 kilovolt, you know, lines, it costs a tremendous amount of money in terms of the substations that you need. And so it takes you to a certain scale of project. But then the flip side is we are in Europe, we are land constrained here. And so you can't necessarily build those very large sizes. And so you just need, you know, a high degree of grid reinforcement and more of those more distributive lines sitting around the areas which you're going to build. And it's not just a challenge here. You know, it's a challenge in the U.S. as well. We were doing a podcast with a U.S. congressman some time ago, and he was making the point that it's actually easier to build a gas pipeline in the United States than it is to build a grid network. And it's because the number of government agencies you need in order to do that is a much larger number than you would for a gas pipeline. And I guess the point is that politics is a big part of this, and that's certainly true also here in Europe, where you know, the ideal position from the European Union, of course, would be to have a European-wide grid network. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's still very political and very local when it comes to those decisions. So let's see what happens.
Yeah, I suppose with the political involvement, you've also got to consider the budget constraints. You know, politicians don't want to go around splashing money. So Certainly. Hopefully some kind of big backing like this from institutionals, from players like the European Investment Bank, will kind of help get over that threshold of resistance. Thank you very much for the news update, Rob. As mentioned at the top of the show, we are expecting some big announcements to come out towards the end of this week from the UK government on net zero policy. Now, to be clear, we are recording this on Wednesday morning, so we don't quite have the full list yet, although quite a lot of it has been trailed out in the media. So here to pick through the details is Dila Cibici. Can you give us a bit of an overview on the day, the kind of announcements we're expecting, the context, an overview, please?
Yes, of course. Government is expected to announce a package addressing a few things, really. And among them, it's expected to be a response to the Skidmore review. And just to remember, the review said that the UK government approach is not aligned with climate science and has inconsistent policies and a mismanaged reporting structure, among other things, that is expected to lead to costly risks and significant delays. It's also been mandated by the High Court ruling that concluded that the current net zero strategy is inadequate and unlawful. But it is also sort of wrapped up in this response to the US's IRA, as well as the EU's strategy that's been coming together over the last few months, really. And again, to remember, the IRA is obviously this vast subsidy package of over $350 billion for energy projects, which is the largest ever package that has been geared towards environmental spending. On the EU side, the bloc is considering loosening state subsidy rules and also removing a significant amount of red tape for clean technology firms. So the UK is already in some ways quite behind and is risking falling further behind if certain incentives and investments aren't being made.
Okay, so the context there, it seems like the government are going to try and kill a lot of birds with a handful of stones here. So we've got the legal obligation to change the net zero policy by the end of March, so they're cutting it close. We talked a bit about the Skidmore report on the podcast a few weeks ago when it was announced, and that was really a comprehensive view of loads of different areas of UK climate, renewables, green industry policy. In essentially every area, there was a recommendation to be made. It could be summarised as speed up the process. Do we have any idea of the kind of specific moves the government might be planning to put out this week?
Yes, and in terms of speeding up the process, it might be worth adding that the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just about 10 days ago has also issued a final warning on the climate crisis itself, saying that only swift and drastic action can avert devastating damage to the world. That being said, it has also crucially said that if we act now, we can still secure a livable future, but it is requiring governments to take drastic actions and potentially even pulling forward the 2050 net zero target goals to 2040 if possible. Against all of these issues in the background, so the hopes for the Green Day / Energy Security Day the expectations are that the renewable energy industry is quite eager for the UK government to provide clarity, really, first and foremost, and a firm and a reliable regulatory framework on key technologies like hydrogen and wind. They're hoping that barriers in grid connectivity, in planning and permission processes will be eased and improved and will gain some guidance. Just something that does justice to the scale of the required transformation really ahead of us, and respecting and including the leading role of renewables in it.
Can you tell us any of the specifics that they might be approaching this with?
Yeah, of course. So some of the green measures that are expected to be included are, of course, renewable energy, sort of looking into onshore and offshore wind. Onshore currently effectively banned in England. Some green measures also in green hydrogen production. EV manufacturing is meant to get a mandate maybe on sale numbers, as well as some focus on heat pumps. However, particular attention is expected to be paid to nuclear energy that has been recently labeled green, as well as hydrogen, as I mentioned, and carbon capture and storage as well.
Of course, nuclear and carbon capture, big features of the recent budget from the Treasury. That reclassification of nuclear energy as green is controversial. We've covered this on the podcast before. Yeah, I think one thing I would say is that this announcement really has a lot riding on it from the government's kind of image point of view, because this is the first kind of big set piece announcement that has come after the reclassification of BEIS. So this is Grant Shapps' new Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, who are going to be sort of at the forefront of these announcements. So it'll be interesting to see how exactly that's taken. And yes, as you said, it seems like there's going to be things touched on from all across the renewables industry. I've got quite a few contacts in the sort of hydrogen space who are getting quite excited, as I mentioned earlier, about the hydrogen business model. There's very likely to be some big funding out there for nuclear to back up this Great British Nuclear Project towards that goal of reaching 24 gigawatts of nuclear by 2050.
I mean, I'll throw a bit of, you know, industry perspective, at least from somebody who builds renewable energy. But, you know, the nuclear industry, I guess a couple of things come to mind when people are promoting it. And so one of our favorite expressions is it's the privatization of gains and the socialization of losses. In that industry benefits from this tremendously, but when it's time to decommission, that very much falls on the taxpayer. So it's always a question, what is the true cost? But let's look at the direct cost. So we have Hinkley C, which is under construction now. I'm not sure how delayed it is, but let's say over a decade. And our next point is, I think to get it off the ground, the government had to promise a 30-year tariff at something like 9 pence per kilowatt hour growing at inflation. Mm. And okay, we're in the inflationary environment now. By the time it finally delivers, is that 9 going to be 14 or 15 or 18 cents? You know, we don't know, but let's take a look. And you say, what is the cost to develop and deliver, you know, solar in the UK? And what is that, 4.5 cents right now, 4.5 pence? So there's, obviously some benefits to nuclear. It's there. It's baseload. It operates 24 hours a day. You could argue that a big cloud comes in and solar does not, or the nighttime, but there's a lot of room between, let's say 4.5 pence and 18 to do all sorts of things with storage, notwithstanding batteries and, of course, the coming hydrogen industry as well. So let's see where this goes. I wonder about how much of this is politics and how much of it is actually going to happen as we go forward over the next decade.
One of the disappointing things that are expected to be announced actually is that there's not going to be a mandate for house builders to include rooftop solar to new housing as well. So that's something people have hoped for, but is expected to be not included. So in terms of the reality maybe of this Energy Security Day and the criticism that has followed, some to begin with, many have pointed out that the launch is going to be made in Aberdeen, which is sort of considered to be the country's oil and gas capital, which many have taken as a sign for the government's intention to maybe fossil fuels or at least deliver a more pleasing or fossil fuel friendly announcement. It is expected that ministries might refuse to force oil and gas companies to stop flaring by 2025, as was recommended in the review of net zero. Other things that were recommended in the were also giving Ofgem, the government office for gas and electricity markets, a net zero remit, but that is also not expected to happen, so it isn't really helping it in becoming a more effective regulator. The Skidmore Review also recommended creating a standalone net zero office, also not expected to happen.
So it seems like, and we talked about this a little bit off the podcast before we began, it seems like there's been a little bit of a briefing war between government departments here, because this was initially billed as a green day, as a day when we could expect green policies. But throughout the week, that seems to have been more and more abandoned in favour of this energy security label. So thank you very much for bringing us up to date on that, Dila. And now, turning back to the solar industry, we have, of course, Scott Lawrence with us today. And Scott, it's great to have you here. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, very happy to. So Scott Lawrence, I'm one of the co-founders of a firm called Glenmont Partners, now part of Nuveen, a much larger U.S. asset management company. But we founded the firm at the end of 2007, and we've been doing renewable energy investments since that time period. So predominantly that was in Europe for the very early part of our lives as a company. And today we're global. So we now have offices, of course, across Europe, but also in the USA, Singapore, and South Korea. My particular role at the firm is governance, looking after our solar portfolio, but also supporting on the new initiatives on the debt side, including our credit fund products as well.
2023 has been a very busy year so far for Glenmont. We've seen you entering new markets in Sweden and South Korea. So what's the significance, really, of these announcements for the company? And have you got similar kind of deals in new markets on the way this year?
So we do, and they are significant for us. So the part of the strategic goal of the firm in joining a bigger asset manager like Nuveen was to be able to access global renewable energy markets on behalf of our clients and our investors. And so that has taken us, of course, to new markets in Europe, but also, say, new markets for us further afield. And so that started with investments, as you rightly point out, South Korea, where we are building a nice pipeline there with our team and started construction on some solar assets in that market. We're doing the same thing in the United States, where we're building, I think, a gigawatt in the Tennessee Valley Authority, let's say, footprint, including battery storage. So a very exciting market there underneath the auspices of the IRA. And it's really allowing us to branch out and do more, but really be represented in what is the mainstream renewable energy markets today.
Yeah. So when you kind of approach a new market like South Korea, which obviously is going to be very different from what you've worked in the past. How do you go about doing that? Is it a matter of looking for a local partner to kind of help give you some guidance?
So that's certainly part of the process, and we do have very good on-the-ground partners who are well-established firms in that particular country. But it also comes down to, let's say, what is our internal capability set and who do we have on our team? And so we do have Korean nationals sitting in the marketplace who are Glenmont people. Very much leading, say, the origination efforts there, but then also overseeing those strategic relationships that we have in country. And all of that is supported by the Home Office here in the UK in terms of our technical and financial expertise.
Yeah. So is that going to be like an Asian base, and then you're going to kind of use that as a springboard into other areas?
The answer is yes. It's our first investment in the region. And what else is attractive in that marketplace? So we are currently an investor in OECD markets. And so that does, let's say, limit the field a bit. But if you look at, you know, what are the OECD countries there, that is South Korea, that is going to be Japan as well. Mm-hmm. And then also interesting for us is potentially Australia.
Yeah.
And solar is the first efforts in this marketplace. But I think you all were discussing earlier floating offshore wind, and we're very much following that because the seabed architecture, let's say off the coast of Japan, is something called a back arc basin. And we are very fortunate here in Europe that the North Sea is very shallow and we can do fixed offshore wind turbines here. But that doesn't work in places like back arc basins. You need to have the floating technology. And as that develops, you know, very much working with our partners in that marketplace to be on top of that. And when it's ready to be invested and investable for an infrastructure investor, we very much plan to be there.
Yeah. I suppose Australia makes a lot of sense because there's a lot of solar opportunities there. Is that something that you're eyeing? to do quite soon.
We're monitoring the marketplace. It's about finding the right entry point, and again, finding transactions that make sense for us on a risk return basis. And that's not always immediately obvious in any new market, and so taking our time, but we should be present there at some point in the future.
So one of the issues with the Australian market from a general renewables point is, yes, there's plenty of renewable resource there, but the off-taker is a much more complicated issue, as it's not got the industrial sector to meet those renewable resources, which you can read more about in our latest Australian research report, which we put out this week.
Great. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, I will say something as kind of a tailwind for the industry is the fact that it is becoming a much more commercial marketplace and a much more market-based, let's say, industry. And we take that as a positive. But if you look at Europe, you look at the United States, the ability to sign, let's say, long-term power purchase agreements with corporates is a great thing for the industry and should unlock a lot of that growth. And the more markets in which that can happen, the better it is for all of us and the volumes that are expected.
Another question that I wanted to ask was about the Nuveen European Core in Renewable Infrastructure Vehicle that I think was launched a few months ago, we'll say.
It made public a few months ago. Yeah. So I guess to take a step back, Clement has essentially three lines of business. So it's our let's say, value-added infrastructure fund, which we're on vintage four of today. We have a green credit, let's say, strategy as well. And so we're on vintage two of that. And then this is basically our NECRI fund, as you rightly point out. And this is a pool of capital on behalf of some clients of our firm who want to buy secondary market exposure in the renewable energy space in Europe. And so it was designed specifically for those clients to go out and purchase secondary assets in the marketplace.
I see. And how is it progressing so far, would you say? I mean,
it's progressing well. So we have made a couple of investments now. So the first one is an onshore wind in Scandinavia. And the second investment, I'm sure soon to be released, is a large offshore wind investment that we've made also here in Europe.
Can you give us any more details on that?
It'll be in the Netherlands, and the rest of it, we'll see it when it comes out.
Oh, okay. Always looking for the scoop there. We'll look forward to reading about that one soon. If you want, I wanted to move on to talk about BNZ,
yes,
which is the IPP which you launched, focuses heavily on the Spanish market. So I was wondering if you could just give us a little bit more insight about why Glenmont kind of felt the need to get involved in an IPP.
Sure. So if we roll the clock back to 2017, 2018, we were in the process of selling some solar assets, and we were looking at the marketplace and saying that the marketplace has changed. And so the perceived risk of solar had come down. I would say the spread over base rates had come down. And generally speaking, it was a much more liquid market, but therefore, let's say on an individual transaction basis, a lower returning market. And so my colleagues and I, we took a step back and we said, what is the right way to approach the European solar market going forward? And we came up with the BNZ strategy in 2018. So we drove it that way. And then we built it up quite slowly with finding, let's say, development partnerships across the continent and Spain, as you mentioned, Portugal and Italy. And I think we're equally split between those three markets. And we've also built a team on the ground in Madrid that's there to deliver on that IPP strategy. And so really, it was our way of saying, what is the right way to allocate our investors' capital in this marketplace? And we felt it was an IPP strategy because of, I guess, the ability to generate scale as one of the first pieces. Because, okay, it's one thing we like to tell people who are new to the industry, but we as a company bought our first megawatt of solar panels in 2008. We paid €3.5 million for that megawatt of solar panels. And you know the prices today, but let's say somewhere well south of 300,000 for that same megawatt. So take off a zero and a bit more, and that's where you are. And that's great. That's great for the industry. That's great for solar being competitive on its own. But it's tough when it comes to getting projects of sufficient scale to be interesting for the institutional markets. And so an IPP allows you to do that. I think the next part is that the industry has become more complex. So we're no longer just a feed-in tariff market. There are lots of things that go into how does one manage revenue. And having a large portfolio, that scale, gives you, let's say, optionality when it comes to how do you manage that revenue and how do you take that whole entire platform forward. It allows you to have more diversification in the ways that you manage that revenue.
So one thing that I would like to dig into a little bit is about the sort of particulars of those regions. So you mentioned Portugal, Spain, and Italy. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, those are some of the markets in Europe where you have the best natural conditions for solar. You've got the best capacity factors. But is there anything more to why particularly those markets are right for this strategy?
Yeah, so I'll take them in turn. So Portugal, there was a time where we were the largest investor in solar in Portugal, very early on in that market's history. So this is going back again to probably 2009 and 10. But during the middle of the European crisis, where everybody else was, you know, say fleeing Southern Europe, we were investing. And I believe the Portuguese sovereign was trading at 13.5% when we made our investments in Portugal. So we've had a long history there. We have great relationships and I think a trusted presence in that we've been there through the bad times and the good times, and we continue to be so. The Italian market is the same. So again, we've been investing there consistently since 2009 and 10 in the solar space. And, you know, we've developed a good network there. We've developed a strong presence there, and we very much like the market and we'll continue to be there. Spain is a newer market for us in terms of our history. We did not invest in early days renewables there, which ended up being fortunate, but you can't ignore the market. It's a big economy in Southern Europe. And I think just for any IPP strategy, you need to have a presence there.
You know, what are some of the kind of the issues, the problems that you face when you're developing projects? We've talked a little bit about finding good connection and the bureaucracy behind planning. Are those the two main issues, or are there any other ones?
I think it is. I mean, you know, we've now all forgotten that COVID existed. And so, you know, it's great that it's gone, but that did cause some delays. And I think that's an industry-wide issue for everybody. And so plans, you know, maybe took a year longer than, you know, initial expectations, but that's fine. And so we're through that period now. You know, the ones that you mentioned are certainly there. I think it's also that the industry is becoming and has to become much more collaborative in the terms of connection points being difficult, having to achieve those higher, let's say, electricity line infrastructure, the substations you need. And that's causing, not for every asset, but for some, the need to, you know, work with those who are in the same region to defer and share some of those costs. And so that just adds an added layer of complexity to projects, but something that the industry is moving through.
So obviously, Glenmont has had experience in lots of different markets around the world. We've been talking about them already, including the US. So why is the IRA really changing the market in terms of how people are viewing the US? You mentioned that it's like a bonus to your existing projects, but it seems to really be galvanizing the support. So what is it that actually makes the difference on the project level?
So I'll answer that question looking at two aspects. I guess one is the politics behind the IRA and what we think, you know, let's say, government is trying to achieve. And, you know, what the positive is we think governments around the world are accepting that the energy transition is a fait accompli. It's happening. It's going to happen. It's definitely there. Now that that is happening, they also want it to be fair. And by fair, they mean jobs. So if you look at, you know, a solar power plant, 80% of everything coming from that is manufactured in China, and the quality is very good, and we're very happy with our suppliers there. But if you're sitting inside of a government in the US or here in Europe, you're saying, okay, well, how can we bring some of that manufacturing back to our domestic shores? And since we're reorienting our economy towards the energy transition, how can we benefit from that, from local people's jobs? And so the IRA, you know, it takes an attempt to crack at that. And you're seeing that a lot of production is therefore moving to the US. And so people like Hanwha Qcells, a supplier of solar modules, is ramping up production in North America as a result of the IRA and what's coming down there. Then taking that down to the project level itself, you know, here in Europe, when you structure a project, it's going to be sponsor equity plus project finance. And in the US, you have sponsor equity, project finance, or what they call back leverage, and then tax equity as this third tranche of capital. And I don't think the projects necessarily need it, but it does make the market more liquid. And what the IRA does is it allows tax equity to be fungible. And it means that it opens up that market to more players, and it makes it a much more liquid market and therefore more participants. And if you think about it from, again, the political hat on, whether you sit on one side of the aisle or the other, and as a US politician, you love tax credits. Mm-hmm. And so we think this is a good way that this legislation will be embedded and will be almost, you know, administration proof, no matter which way the political winds happen to go.
Of course, because we were writing just, could it only be 2 years ago, about the uncertainty of the US system and, you know, whether there'd be institutional problems there with stability on that political level. But I do want to pick you up on one more thing that you said there, mm-hmm. about the bringing the supply chain away from producers in China and in the US. Essentially, that's going to be adding more producers, more solar manufacturers to the market. Now, do you think that could actually have knock-on benefit effects to the price of renewables around the world, not just in the US, but it seems to me that there'll be just more competition for these kind of supply contracts?
I think that's right, and just volumes in general. If you're to look at any of the national energy plans here in Europe, you know, the energy transition is happening and there's going to be more investment here. And more investment means more supply. And again, that's where you have further benefits from economies of scale and economies of scope. And right now, the manufacturers are working on, you know, how much more of the light spectrum can they capture. But there will be other things there that are just bringing down that cost on a per kilowatt basis. And we hope for the same in storage as well.
We've covered an awful lot of ground here. Thank you so much for your time today. Are you optimistic about the future of the industry?
Very much so. Listen, we've been in this for a very long time. We started Glenmont at the end of 2007, and the energy transition has happened even faster than we as real believers had expected. So we have been very pleasantly surprised over the past 15 years at how fast things are moving and continue to move. I mean, the market is very dynamic and it continues to grow. So there will be headwinds from time to time. I mean, you know, we're not immune from the greater economy, but the general direction of travel is a very positive one for our industry and we think for the world as well. So optimistic.
Fantastic. And I think that's a wonderful note to end on. I would like to thank all of our contributors today, Robert Leeming, Dila Chibici, and our guest, Scott Lawrence. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll be back again with more news and more analysis after the Easter break. We're taking a 1 week break, but we will be back. Thank you very much for listening. All inquiries can be sent to podcasts@inspiratia.com. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.